successful on Wednesday. They went out and worked on the robotic arm. It's been worked on before, and now the other half of it, they needed to actually grease it. It's the equivalent of greasing it. The robotic arm that's attached to the space station was built by Canada years ago. They call it Canada Arm 2. It's an offspring of the original arm that was put on all the space shuttles. So it wasn't really designed to really last all this long. So it wasn't designed to be greased and go through this whole process. They did it on a previous spacewalk, and they did it last Wednesday as well. That worked out okay. They also ran some wires getting ready for the new ITER that will eventually be going up there. The ITER is the International Docking Adapter. There will be eventually two of them on the American side, which will allow any future craft, especially the commercial craft, to dock with people, on astronauts on board. And the docking adapters, one of them was lost back in June when SpaceX was bringing one up, and that was during the explosion of the Falcon 9. They lost the ITER. So there was another one already being built. They needed two, and then they had a lot of spare parts originally from the original one that is almost complete. They're putting a third one now together to replace the one that blew up. Looking forward to another spacewalk as they put an installation around the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, and that worked out okay. And the next spacewalk, I know they're going to work on some cooling lines, things that have to do with the radiator system on the International Space Station. So a couple of other things, the Dawn spacecraft, which I know we've been following on the net for like forever. Dawn is the one that has all these ion engines. Took many years to get to two different asteroids, Vista, and now it's at Cirrus. Went into orbit around Vista, spent a year and a half or so there, and then deorbited that and went to Dawn. Now it's doing the same thing. They plan on this week they plan on going into the lowest orbit. They started off like 1,500 miles above the planet when they I call it planet, but above the asteroid. And then over the years they fly the ion engines. It takes months to change the orbit altitude, and they keep dropping it, progressively, and then they take pictures. And now it's going to go into its final low orbit of around 200 miles. Right now it's at 900, which should drop down to around 200 miles. It'll stay there, virtually forever. It doesn't have enough fuel on board to deorbit. So, it started out a couple of thousand pound spacecraft, and half of that was xenon gas. Xenon gas is the, in a liquid form, was the fuel for the ion engines. So that's all starting to drop little by little over all these years. They fire these engines, at a year at a time, a couple of years at a time. They sometimes they don't shut them off. They'll shut them off, every maybe week or two to repoint the spacecraft back to Earth to communicate with Earth, and then they'll turn it back on again. So, very successful. Not one of them has failed. They had three on board. They really only used two, and they have another one as a backup. It's worked out okay. They have gimbling systems on there, so they can change its attitude and run an advanced system. So, ion engines now are the way to go. I mean, even putting them on synchronous satellites now after the success of Dawn to have a less expensive way of getting the satellites into its final geosynchronous orbit. So I wanted to cover that and another topic, the SLS, Space Launch System. They've come up with a final design on everything and they're really nailing everything down. Things are starting to go into production. They're getting away from the engineering and actually putting molecules together. And they've decided on leaving the external tank. Very similar to the external tank that was on the shuttle. This tank has got oxygen and hydrogen on board. Now, you might remember the first two flights of the space shuttle system. The tanks were painted white. We discussed that on the net many years ago. And then they eventually went over to its natural color of orange.
Where is that power coming from? Is it a nuclear? nuclear source, or is it solar panels? Where's the power coming from for these many hours of thrust at ionic engine? Hope you call K2RIW.
Sometimes many years. The panels are about 60 feet long. Don't have one. One side and the other. So, it's like a 100-foot spacecraft because of these panels. So, that's where they get it. Well, and then, of course, they have these, I think there's two 35-amp batteries located on the spacecraft. You got like a five meter diameter antenna. The antenna is like 15 feet in diameter or something like that. Some big antenna. You take had a rating at one time of how many watts. It was 10,000 watts near the Earth, but that drops off tremendously in very square law out by way past Mars, probably 2 AU, so it's probably a 4, divide that by 4, probably 2,500, maybe tops 3,000 watts of power it's getting. So that's what's running the ion engines. Back to you there.
One of the YouTube videos I saw showed solar sails. At first you would think a solar sail is going to really be doing more of its thrusting by way of the solar wind. And I think one of the YouTube videos told me that the solar photonic pressure is many times larger on a solar sail than the solar wind. So the photon pressure against a reflective sail gives you a certain amount of significant thrust. Now, those solar panels are sucking up photon energy from the sun, converting it into electrical power. The electrical power, in turn, becomes thrust of an ionic engine. In theory, it sounds like you could bypass a good significant amount of that hardware if you use the solar sail and took the photon energy directly and reflected it back toward the sun in order to get thrust out of it. On paper, it sounds good. Let me drop it. But in order to create that many square feet of reflecting material, have it properly oriented, have it sufficiently reflective, and survive the deployment. And I think, what did they say? Four and a half microns is the thickness of the solar sail material in one of the YouTube videos that I saw. So, have any of these spacecraft done any further experiments on solar sailing, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, Japan launched one on their H2 rocket a couple of years ago, and they said that was somewhat successful. It showed it was maneuvering in orbit around Earth, and then the Planetary Society, for many years, have been pushing for solar sails. They launched one not too long ago, about a year or so ago. It was relatively small, I think maybe a meter or two on one side. And if they wanted to show that it would deploy, it could open up. And yeah, very, very thin. And it showed it was working. Again, it could change velocity. But now in 2016, probably toward the end of 2016, whenever SpaceX finally gets there, Falcon 9 Heavy. Falcon 9 Heavy is, you take three Falcon 9s and bubble them together and launch the thing. That's really what they mean by that. 27 engines instead of 9 engines. Now they got to, they want to show that they can launch this thing, and SpaceX, has experimental satellites on board, but it's really a demonstration launch. Well, one of the small satellites that they're putting on there, and it's only, I think they said 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters by 30, it's a small box. So what is that? little momentum wheels, little tiny gyro type things inside the spacecraft, which is going to turn the spacecraft edge on. And then as it goes around the Earth and starts to orbit going away from the Earth, the momentum wheels will spin up and face the spacecraft base on, toward the sun. Now the photons here, they come along. By the way, I think it's a 4-to-1 ratio. It's 4 times more powerful than the solar wind. You mentioned that before. That's what I read, Dick. Well, now the photons will be pushing the sail, and now it'll achieve a higher orbit. And again, as it comes around, each time it comes around, surprised that in time out, each time it comes around, the momentum wheels will rotate the spacecraft. Edge on, face on. It'll just keep getting higher and higher in their altitude until it eventually breaks orbit, and then it's off to the races to see how fast this thing goes away from Earth. So that's the plan. Should be interesting flight. Planetary Society. That's the science guy now. He's CEO or whatever, president of of that group now. Originally started, one of the co-founders was Carl Sagan decades ago. And he was the one that pushed for solar sails. He felt that would be a good way to eventually gain terrific speed. Not quite light speed, but, anything better than chemical rockets. He was in favor of doing that because the universe is so big. Just to get to another planet, it takes forever. So that's the latest on solar sails. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the nice thing about a solar sail is you get the thrust essentially for free. The bad news, though, is that if you wanted the thrust to occur in the direction toward the sun, you can't get it. An ion engine can do that for you. A solar sail can't. And in the case of sailing on planet Earth, when you want to sail into the wind, you can do something that's called tacking. You zigzag back and forth. But there's a catch. When you're zigzagging back and forth, you are getting forward thrust toward the wind, but you're using the side thrust of the water. The keel pressing against the water is giving you a conversion of left and right energy being converted into a forward thrust. You haven't got that fluid medium out there in space, so there's no way, as I see it, that you can directly use a solar sail to get thrust toward the sun. Yes, you can do it cyclically when you're in orbit, but you can't do it if you are not in orbit around some other body. You're floating free, and you want to now get thrust toward the sun with a solar sail. I think you cannot do it with an ionic engine and a solar panel. You can, right, John? Now, this spacecraft that you described, Paul, with 27 engines, what's a rough guess as the total number of megapounds of thrust that can create? Over you, Paul, K2RIW.
Okay, and just to go back to the solar sails. I always was wondering about that myself, and he had it in one of his books, Pale Blue Dot, and that was my question. How could you have this thing come back toward the sun? And back in the computer days, when to get these guest people getting onto the computer, and you could ask questions live, you type it into the computer and you hope that they're going to answer your question. Well, he was doing that one time, so I got on the computer and I asked that very same question to Carl Sagan. And I have all the people asking questions. He picked up my question, and he answered that. And he did call it tacking into the sun, and he used gravity as some kind of counterforce. And he had this whole big plan on how to do it. He did answer the question. So I cared more about talking to him than listening to the answer, but he did answer that question. The Falcon 9 is what, 1.? I think it's 1.5, going up to 1.6. Let me drop it. The next flight that goes up will be in probably December, when they return to flight. SpaceX is not, you know, they're increasing the thrust on the existing Merlin engines. They're called Merlin engines, each one, and then nine of them. So that'll be going up to a total of 1.6 million pounds. So it's a big engine. Now you're going to put three of these things together. They're looking over probably, I don't know, 5.5 million pounds, some big number like that. Big number, Dick. Be launched from Cape Canaveral. Originally planned years ago, it was going to have its maiden flight from Vandenberg, but they changed that to Cape Canaveral. Back to you.
What you told us earlier is that you had direct communication with Carl Sagan. Maybe one of the very few people on Long Island that's done that. And it's too bad that he did get cancer and is no longer with us. Very effective guy. And Johnny Carson had him on quite frequently. Carson was quite interested in astronomy, astrophysics, cosmology, and had Sagan on quite often. In fact, some people, the non-science people, were even complaining that he was on too often. For you and me, it was not on often enough. And some of those documentaries, some of those educational programs that Sagan made were, in my opinion, quite good. But when you're tacking with a sailboat on Earth, that fluid gives you a certain, the sideways thrust converted into forward thrust of the fluid, the water, against the keel of the boat and against the side of the hull. Let me drop it. That allows you to make that tacking motion into an equivalent forward motion. Unless you're in orbit around some other body, I don't think you can do that with a solar sail. I don't think tacking is possible. By the way, when you're adjusting the solar sail to be edge on when you're in orbit and going toward the sun, and then you make it flat out when you're going away from the sun, and you'd like to be able to do that reorientation pretty fast, when you've got this very large solar sail, which has got a lot of moment of inertia, to make that motion with inertial wheels is a little bit difficult as I see it. Too bad there isn't a way that you can do steering panels at the perimeter, where you open and close panels to do steering, somewhat like is going on with Kepler. Kepler is doing that kind of steering right now, aren't they, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, okay. Well, I don't know. I don't have no problem. I mean, they turn all kinds of spacecraft with the, you know, with these momentum wheels. And then the power for that is, you know, there will be solar panels also on the spacecraft. So they'll have enough power to spin up these wheels. You know, you come around, your early orbits will probably be, you know, 90, you know, a little over 90 minutes. So, you know, spend a little time changing the attitude of the spacecraft as it goes toward the sun and spin them up the other way to, you know, or maybe they'll even get it into some kind of resonant system where it'll be rotating just at the right speed. I don't know, they've used these things, you know, forever. All many different spacecraft, no problem. In fact, they had them on the International Space Station early on. They still do. It's located in the Z1 truss section, along with the gyros. You know, you can stabilize or actually turn the whole space station with these things. I don't know. Now, the other question was what? Back to you, Jeff.
Yeah, could you do it with a little steering paddle? No. Momentum wheels, inertial wheels.
Well, that's right.
Momentum wheels allow you to do steering, but you're really winding them up. In other words, in order to reorient your spacecraft, you're either increasing or decreasing the RPM of one of those momentum wheels, and periodically you've got to use some chemical energy to de-spin them. However, you know, when you have an ordinary top or an ordinary gyroscope, and you watch it slowly settle down, it does a motion that's called precessing. And if your gyroscope wheel is turning clockwise, let me think about that. I think it will precess top view in a clockwise direction. And if you turn it counterclockwise, it'll precess the other way. I did an experiment once where I took a pair of gyroscopes, connected them together with soldered wires side by side, and the idea was I brought them, they were connected side by side, rigidly to each other, and then the common point between the two gyroscopes came down to a sharp point. Let me drop it. And my whole philosophy was, rather than have this thing precess, I'm going to cancel the precessing by spinning one gyroscope clockwise and one gyroscope counterclockwise, set it up vertical and let go. When they did that, what do you think would happen, then, Paul? I did that experiment. WS2N, K2RIW.
I don't know, you think it would work, you know, you look at these little helicopters now that they have, and they, all the toy helicopters, the RC ones, and they have two spinning blades, one going one way, the other one going the other way, that works. You would think your idea with the Kepler's would work as well. And yeah, Kepler's is the same idea. Yeah, I know it, you mentioned Kepler before, so... Yeah, it's got the solar panels, and they're using that. They're basing it. You know, it surrounds the body. It's like surrounding a tin can with solar panels. Four solar panels. But they don't stick out. They're not sticking out like wings, you know. So it's like taking a can and laying it down on its side, put a couple of panels, and having the point of one of the panels facing the sun and just have it just balanced just right, and that's what they're doing. But yeah, that's the reason you got K2, the momentum wheel quit working on that one. They had four. One was a backup, and now that broke, and then the other one broke. You need three to do it properly to have anything turn, you know, if you want to turn everything in the right, you know, rotate right, rotate left, and, you know. But you're saying you got to use chemical action. I don't think they use chemical reaction rockets at all. You know, you spin them up, it'll go one way, and you put the brakes on, and it'll stop, and you can go the other way. In fact, you do.
Yeah, but some spacecraft will develop a continuous yaw as a function of a solar wind or whatever. And therefore, you tend to get a... momentum wheel correcting that, and then eventually the momentum wheel is going faster and faster, and you're getting to the maximum RPM, and you can only de-spin it and still maintain your desired orientation by using your reaction control jets, by using chemical energy. And so I was hoping that by having a pair of momentum wheels, a pair of gyroscopes spinning in opposite directions, you could now move them in a way to give you thrusting without building up momentum and building up RPM. Unfortunately, the answer is no. In that dual gyroscope that I made, if I spun just one gyroscope, it would behave in the normal manner and precess, except it would precess a little bit faster because it's twice as much mass and a higher center of gravity of this dual gyroscope system coming down to a common point. If I spun both gyroscopes in the same direction, it acted very nicely, normal precession. And by the way, a clockwise spinning gyroscope wheel, as it settles down, will precess in a counterclockwise manner. Now, if you spin the two gyroscope wheels, maximum speed in opposite directions, you think you're canceling the precession. The magic of the precession is where the gyroscope action is coming from. You spin them both the same velocity in opposite directions, set it up as a gyroscope, and you let go, and it flops over and falls down immediately, even though the spinning is full speed. It's a very sobering thing to watch, Paul. You can't get rid of that
repeater. Time out.
Whenever you're taking the vector direction of the turning axle of a gyroscope, and you try to push it in some other direction. If I push it to the north, it'll respond by moving to the west. It always moves at right angles to the force that you've applied. That's what gyroscopic action is, and it's that action that creates the precession. And you think you're going to cancel that phenomenon by having a pair of gyroscopes in opposite direction. Without that precession, you get no gyroscopic stiffness. Ain't that crazy? It's a very sobering thing to watch. I was very surprised at that result. WS2N, K2RIW, would you have predicted that?
Sounds terrible. That's awful. No, you know, I wouldn't think that either. No. It's just, I guess if you sit down and do the math, combine the two, or maybe even three gyroscopes together, but you would think that work out. No, well, get a good idea of that. You know, I know it's common, everybody probably knows this, but to actually do this, when I was a kid in high school, we took earth science, and I think every school should have this. Maybe they do nowadays, but you take that bicycle wheel, sit on a stool, you know, a rotating stool, spin that thing, and the kid starts turning in one direction, and then you stop it and spin it the other way, and watch the kid go the other way. I think that's probably one of the best lessons. Kids always get a big kick out of it when they do that. That anybody could start, you know, get an interest in gyroscopes. Amazing. Back to you, Dick.
If you're sitting on a rotatable stool, and you've got a rather large gyroscope in your hand, and the axis of the gyroscope is at the right angle to your body, and now you start trying to aim the gyroscope more to the left or to the right, you try to change its angle of that shaft with reference to you, I'm reasonably sure you could make the person move a significant number of degrees clockwise or counterclockwise on that pivotal stool. What do you think, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, oh yeah, that's what happens. But a lot to it, you know. Well, as long as you realize you're going to go off at a right angle, it's interesting. Same with the Earth, right? We're not facing the same star as we were 25,000 years ago. You know, the North Star doesn't become the North Star, you know, 25,000 years from now. I think it's going to be Vega or something. Back to you, Dick.
Now, one of the very interesting experiments I saw them do on the space shuttle in the early days when I was watching NASA Select with my satellite system, they had these toy gyroscopes that could be that could be attached to each other like pop beads. And so you could try to create a stable platform by having one gyroscope where the axis is parallel to the x-axis, another gyroscope where the axis is parallel to the y-axis, and you put the two together, now have a stable platform. I think there is no way you could move it where one of those gyroscopes would not be fighting you. So the platform would stay steady in XYZ orientation. Let me think about that. If you try to twist it around X, the Y will stop you.
This reflector has blocked your node from connecting. An explanation has been sent by email to your node operator.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
John, are we getting a message by way of Echolink or some other way that we should be responding to? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick. That is the response from the Eastern Link. It thinks it's 1 o'clock, so it's trying to time out. Now, because we are using the frequency and we're consistently holding the key, it may not reset, so we'll just have to go and see what happens, but don't worry about it.
Yeah, I just went and looked, and the Eastern Link is following us. It's with us. So, with these copied gyroscope-like things, Paul. You had one parallel to the x-axis, one parallel to the y-axis, and now I think there's no way you could change x, y, or z orientation. That platform is completely stable. You now add a third gyroscope. You had one along the x-axis, one along the y-axis, and you add a third one along the z-axis. At the instant you do that, the whole thing becomes unstable. It starts spinning around an axis that's midway between the X, Y, and Z, and it starts spinning so fast that it flies apart. So, you can put two gyroscopes together at right angles, but you can't put a third one in there and call it stable. That I wouldn't have predicted, but now I think I see what's going on. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, I never saw that demonstration on a space station. It was back in the early days. That might have been a demonstration on Mir. That was a long time ago. Maybe that's what you were watching. They used to have all the scientific experiments on that space station as well. But I don't know, I would think you got to get to a certain point. The RI-3 might not work, but suppose you had, suppose you had 12. You made a box. I think you would have a stable platform. You could put that, since you're in microgravity, put it in the middle of the Destiny lab. If you want to move that, it probably, I would think that would be a stable, if they're all spinning at the same time. A little expensive with 12 gyroscopes, but that would be fun. Looking at the time, I know you want to get a N2EO in there, but back to you, Dick. This is WS2N.
Comments about gyros, Dick?
Yeah, two gyros at right angles to each other is stable. You add a third one that's at right angles to the first two, and it becomes unstable. So you can't put 12 gyroscopes in a box, Paul, and have them all rigidly connected by way of the box to each other. I think it will not be stable for a very complicated reason, which I can explain. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Yeah, Dick, both of my cameras, the Hasselblad and the Leicas, had gyro mounts. There were two gyros. You would take the battery and spin them up to 50,000 RPMs, and they would hold that camera steady. And that's before they had the steady shot and things like that in the dark ages. But there was only two gyros, and it worked extremely well. It was actually tough to turn the camera.
Would I be correct in guessing that those two gyros were at right angles to each other from all you can tell, John?
I believe you're right, Dick. They were all in a unit that mounted on the bottom of the camera, but yes, it looked that way to me because you could see where the armatures of the motors, they were sort of in a round chamber, and it looked like they were at 90 degrees.
Where did the power come from to spin them up? How long did it take to spin them up? And did you hear a whirring sound when they were spun up? John, go ahead.
Oh, definitely. You could hear them winding up, and it took about a minute. With a 12-volt battery, you could do it from the cigarette lighter or, small 12-volt battery and just wind them up. And they would last quite a long time. They would spin up and stay that way for a couple of minutes.
So once you've got the camera stabilized in the way that you described, if I was now in a fast-moving automobile and I'm aiming that camera out the windshield, out the front window, would I be able to now get a pretty steady picture, even though the car is bouncing around on a rough road? Over to you, John.
Yes, you would. We used them on the boats when we were traveling over high waves and things, and it's very difficult to hold a camera in frame. And we were using high speed, and you could run off, on the 400-frame film base, we'd run off like 30 shots at once, and every one of them would be perfect. It worked extremely well.
And you were doing it with brute force by way of good sized gyro. You were stabilizing the whole darn body of the camera. Nowadays, with these stabilized binoculars and things like that, There's only a mirror you're moving inside, which does the compensation, and it makes you think that there is no jitter in the picture that you're looking at through those lenses. WJOHN, K2RIW.
Yeah, that steady shot stuff works really well. Also, they made a gimbal you could mount your camera, which no matter what orientation the vehicle or vessel you were on would turn, the gimbal would keep the camera dead on target. And you could put a crosshair on something and it would stay right there almost without any doubt, you know, within reason. But yeah, you're right. The new cameras, that steady shot stuff works pretty well.
Rich N2EO, I think you said you wanted to discuss a classic piece of radio gear, a historic piece, and too bad I cut you off because I haven't yet reset my watch, and I thought we were approaching 12 o'clock. I was an hour wrong. N2EO, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich. Yeah, we may have put him to sleep. I think he's got to get his beauty rest. I think he doesn't keep our kind of hours, John. In that respect, he's a little smarter than we are. Those experiments that I was describing to you, Paul, were on the space shuttle. And I was watching space shuttle live what the astronauts are doing by way of my satellite system, my TVRO, watching a channel that was called NASA Select. And so you could watch the astronauts essentially 24 hours a day as long as they were not in a sleep period. And I can remember on a number of occasions, let me drop, they'd be flying over South America at nighttime, and there'd be a thunderstorm down there in Brazil. And boy, watching the top view of all those lightning strikes and the way they happened in bursts. In other words, you could come up with a theory that there'd be a great big cloud of cosmic rays coming from space hitting Brazil. And so a number of these thunderbolts that were just at the threshold of triggering, along come a blast of cosmic rays, and they all triggered at roughly the same time. You would see them, you could see a lightning bolt in northern Brazil, southern Brazil, eastern Brazil, and western Brazil, and they all go off at essentially the same time. And then there'd be a delay, and then that process would be repeated. So you could tell there was some kind of coupling action between them. I wonder if you've ever seen any movies of that, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
I've seen plenty of lightning and things like that from space. One show had the story about the sprites, these things that would come above the stratosphere into the ionosphere. That was pretty good. But, okay, you're discussing, you're saying that was on board the shuttle. Probably had the, there was a lot of flights that they went up with Skylab, how do they call it, lab. It was the shuttle lab that they had in the back, in the cargo bay. Space lab, I think they called it. They would go, you know, through the same door, the hatch, and they would go through a 1 meter diameter, a little bit bigger than 1 meter diameter tunnel, and they'd wind up in the cargo hold, which contained the space lab, and that's where they would do all the scientific experiments. They'd go up with a crew, like up a gate, and you'd have the blue team and the red team, and they would do like 12-hour shifts. And, you know, red team would be in the sky lab, and maybe that's when they were doing all these experiments. And on board, yeah, I used to like NASA Select. When we first got cable here in the 80s, they had that, and then they eventually canceled it. Cablevision just did away with it. That was terrible. Back to you, Dick.
And by way of my satellite system, I didn't suffer from that canceling. And NASA was continuously supplying it on, I can't think of the name of the satellite I was aiming toward to get it. I'd like to reestablish that system. was the early flight of shuttle. I know the International Space Station didn't exist yet. I'm not sure that the Mir existed. This was well after Skylab, but before International Space Station for sure, and maybe before Mir. I don't remember ever, at that period of time, seeing the space shuttle going to Mir. I'm not sure whether or not they ever did.
And so made five flights.
Say that again?
Made five flights, five separate flights to Mir with the space shuttle, different space shuttles.
Roughly what year do you think those five flights took place, Paul?
Let's see, Mir was a 15-year mission. Russians didn't want to pay for it anymore. They deorbited that in, what, 1997, I believe, right before the first piece of the ISS went up. So, probably, the five flights probably took place from 1993 to 1997, something like that.
Okay. My satellite system arrived at my house in 1985. So, I guess in the period from around 85 to 95 is when I was doing a lot of shuttle watching of the NASA Select.
Okay, and then it was Space Hab. It had to be the Space Hab in the back of the cargo bay.
Not always. Sometime on the second or third deck in that empty space.
You're right.
Sometime in that empty space is where they would do some of these experiments. And they'd be doing experiments with gyroscopes and I'm trying to think what are the kinds of so-called scientific toys. I believe Krista McAuliffe was going to do quite a number of experiments with these so-called science toys. I think that was planned, wasn't it, Paul?
Oh, yeah, she had a whole itinerary planned out. Yeah, that's a shame that never happened. But her backup, Barbara Morgan, eventually went up. Took, I think, 15 years later. He went up and did what Krista McAuliffe was going to do.
Yeah, those chunks of foam that were breaking off from a very specific spot where there was a mounting flange on the external tank. And that mounting flange, there was no good way you could put foam insulation there without it going into what's called cryopumping. The actual surface of the metallic surface of the external tank is being cooled to cryogenic temperatures by the liquid oxygen, liquid helium, liquid hydrogen that's inside. And so as the external surface of that foam gets cooled, you get evaporation, you get condensation of the water vapor in the high humidity air around Cape Canaveral or Kennedy Space Center. And in the extreme case, you also get liquefaction of air. And I think they call that cryopumping. So you eventually build up liquids and solids in the foam, which have got a lot of mass. And when that breaks away, that mass of material hitting the leading edge of the wing or hitting the shroud on the solid rocket booster can do damage. And they were seeing lots of dents for many of those flights because of the damage of those chunks of foam. The foam itself, let me drop it. The foam itself is a low-density material, which doesn't have a hell of a lot of destructive capability. But when that foam is packed with water, ice, or liquid air, boy, it's now got some real mass and it can do some damage. Tried all kinds of ways of stopping the foam from doing that. I wonder, had they considered putting a heater on that foam? I mean, there's only place, a couple of very specific places where there was a knuckle coming out of the external tank that was mounted to the rest of the space shuttle. You only would have to put a heater in certain areas. If the external surface of the foam was being heated so it didn't get a chance to get water condensation and or liquefaction of air, I think they could have stopped the problem. That's a guess. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
And I believe they did put some heaters near where the tanks hoping thing. Just, you know, they never thought that the foam would come off in such big chunks and cause that kind of a problem. And then when they ran the test afterward, after STS-107 disintegrated, they ran tests to see, you know, if it was possible for the insulation to create a hole in the carbon-carbon wing structure, the leading edge of the wings. They put these pieces of foam in some kind of an air gun, and they blasted it at like 500 miles an hour, and, you know, hitting the carbon-carbon, and without any humidity, without what you said, which would, of course, would make it a lot worse, you know, almost like sending an ice crystal into the carbon-carbon. It was just foam and blue holes right through it. I don't know if you remember seeing that when they show those demonstrations. K2RIW, WS2S.
I sure do remember those demonstrations, and that was extremely striking. I think lots of people were very shocked. They were positive that those foams coming out of that air cannon would not penetrate that leading edge. And when it did, and it blew a hole in it, boy, was that an eye-opening. Terrible problem. And so with that hole in that leading edge and the real hot air coming in during reentry and melting everything inside that wing, that's a pretty wicked way to go. I was trying to think of another technique. Somebody must make a kind of insulation that's not going to be doing that effect. Although maybe the answer is no. As I see it, the longer the external tank sat on the launch pad, the more it was collecting moisture. So if you got scrubbed the first day, and now you attempt to make a launch the second day, I think there's a hell of a lot more risk on the second day. If we look at all of the shuttle damage that occurred from foam, I'll bet you there was a lot more damage on second day launches versus first day launches. What do you think, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, you would think so, but, you know, I mean, there were some launches that were delayed, you know, 7-8 times, you know, and then they'd go up with no problem. And, well, the one Columbia, you know, during that mission, that was the 25th shuttle mission, and they, you know, they thought they had it down to a science. And I think that was at least four scrubs. They were getting frustrated. They want, you know, even the politics of it, they wanted to get this thing up because, you know, Christopher McCullough was going up first, you know, really a non-astronaut doing this. And I know Reagan wanted to make a speech that night. So there was a push for that. And it was very cold on that January 27th. So after that, they said, that's it, no more non-astronauts are going up. In fact, Barbara Morgan, the one that was taking her place, had to actually qualify as an astronaut before she went up 10, 15 years later. NASA's never sent an independent person up ever again. We used to do it all the time. Senator Gahn from Utah, Congressman Nelson, now Senator Nelson of Florida. I mean, these guys were not astronauts. So that whole policy has changed.
How did this senator get permission to go on the shuttle? How did that come about? What was the justification for that, Paul? Go ahead.
One, he wanted to. That was Senator Gordon from Utah. Number two, there's a lot of money coming into his state, and because that was a company called Morton Thiokol at the time, and they eventually became part of ATK, which is now part of Orbital. Orbital is now the ones that launch Antares from Virginia, from Wallops Island, and now it's called Orbital ATK. Well, ATK Kyle built the solid booster rockets for the shuttle. I mean, they built these things, and they're still building them. They are going to be the ones that are building the solid booster rockets for the SLS system. They'll have two on them, two of those rockets, just very similar to the shuttle setup, except bigger. Instead of a four-segmented thing, they're going to have five-segmented rockets. It's going to be longer. So there's a lot of money. We're talking about big billions, you know, that type of money coming into the state of Utah. So that's how he got a ride.
Maybe they didn't like him, Dick.
Yeah, right. And then Senator, at the time, Congressman Nelson. See, they wanted somebody from the Senate to go, and they wanted somebody from Congress to go, so these two guys went. And, back then they were doing this. I mean, we set up this guy was one guy from Arabia, some prince of, prince of some billionaire somewhere. He went up. Early flights were unbelievable, what was going on. Dick?
Now, you said earlier that there were a number of shuttle flights that got scrubbed 2, 3, 4, 5 times. I think each scrub consisted of a day's worth of attempt to launch, and at the end of the day, you would decide to scrub, and you would decide to come back the next day and try again. And the astronauts would go rest for some significant number of hours. But I think after the second day of scrub, I believe they unloaded all the cryogenics from the external tank, cleaned it out, and started all over again. So I don't think you had 3 or 4 consecutive days of scrub. I think they would only scrub for 2 days maximum and then unload everything. Am I wrong on that one, Paul? WS2N, K2RAW?
No, you're right. They still do it to this day. I mean, even the commercial guys, SpaceX, you know, when they have a scrub, same thing. They take all the fuel out. All right, the RP-1, that's kerosene, that's not cryogenically cooled. Although now, with the new rocket, they're actually going to change that. That will be on the cold side. They're actually going to... They realize that if you make RP-1, the rocket propellant, kerosene, super cold, or very cold, you could condense it. You could actually, it will be more dense, and you could actually get more fuel on board your Falcon 9 rocket. So that's going to be part of the next flight as well. But yeah, I mean, you're right, 100%. They take all the fuel out. Now you wonder, did that weaken that strut? Is a strut inside of the Falcon 9 that is being blamed for breaking? A little helium tank broke on the inside, and it was inside the oxygen tank, and that made the oxygen tank overpressurize and blew up the whole second stage of the Falcon 9 rocket. You know, I mean, it's a possibility. I agree with you, Dick. Back to you.
Okay, if you got a second day of scrub, and you're going to unload the liquid oxygen and hydrogen, how do you unload that? You don't just pump it out. Do you boil it off? And if you boil it off, do you just release it to the atmosphere, or do you try